in the coal mining district and was born in a coal mining camp there at approximately around the middle of Burke, Kentucky there, and coal mining town too. And, that was born in 1910, as you know, and it wasn't easy.
Okay.
In the mountains, and I couldn't hardly live. So approximately a year I got out of that, and they found me a job out on the yard outside, and they picked me for that job. And the superintendent called and said to tell him to not go back in the mines, and report on the yard in the morning. So we wanted him as our head spragman man to drop in our coal cars and stuff. So he's the boy for it. At the age, at 17, I had that job, a very good job. But I decided this coal mining was not for me. So I pulled stakes, intended to go to Florida where I owned some land. And I think, well, I'll go up and see my sister first. And I did, in Michigan. And while I was here, they coaxed me into staying. And I never did get to Florida to my land. I thought I'd go down there and stay, get a job and my land down there. So they coaxed me and I stayed. Well, I wound up getting married, raising a family, and that is where it first started.
Okay. What age were you then when you moved to Monroe?
I was the age of 19 years old.
Okay.
When I came to Monroe.
Okay. Now, up until the last 3 months ago, you lived in what, in the East End, in what we call the Orchard.
Yeah.
Were there as many black families living there when you first moved into the East End as there are now?
No, there was not. There was very few. And what happened during that, so many colored people that's in Monroe today, it's happened when this great steel mill that I worked at myself when they was building it, they brought these colored people in from down Youngstown, Ohio, the mill, steel mill they had there. And so they stayed here and just kept accumulating and still are and probably always will be. And they just families after families, and now that's why we have so many.
What was the name of that steel factory?
People in Monroe. That was the steel mill down there. It was called the Newton Steel Company. Newton Steel Company. And I worked down there for 50 cents an hour, which was good money back in 29-30. And up till the following year of November, and their contractors were done. And I didn't work any place then from then up till the following March of that year.
Do you remember, did you work there during the great Newton Steel strike?
No, I didn't work after production started at that strike. I didn't work on any production. I had intention to go back because I had run their overhead cranes down there moving stock and stuff. And I had a good chance, but some way or other, I didn't want that job down there from the looks of the people. Been working in those colored people, their teeth is all eat out, and they were in bad shape. And I decided I don't want that steel mill work. So I just waited, and the plane I started at second day I hit Monroe, I went back to that, and eventually work was bad. You'd work a day or two now and then. I stayed with that anyway and helped my seniority up from that first date up till I retired in 1974 from that day on.
Okay. Were you always comfortable with living among blacks in that area?
Well, there was some that was better to me than some of the whites. I had some good neighbor colored people do anything for me, and most of them either joined me on the three sides of my property, and they was very good to me and still are. And one man, the best of my had, neighbor, he moved down in Tennessee and sold his home here. So he comes up, he always looks me up and do anything in the world for you. Hmm. For others, was just in them to be mean, and they was mean with it.
You raised 7 children.
Yeah.
What advice would you give parents today on how to raise children?
I would say the advice, they've got a certain cut out for them to work to help the children get educated, which I didn't have that great chance to get an education like the people as fortunate today to have education like we do today, and very little education did I have, because I worked lived with a stepfather, and he was mean as a rattlesnake on the 4th of July, and he worked me to death and broke me down when I was 14 years old. And I don't know, it's just studied by it a whole lot.
Describe your circumstances during the Depression.
Well, it was circumstances when that Depression was on. If you had the money in the bank, I had some, and I didn't get none of it back. The only thing I got back was some used furniture and stuff like that, and they kept my money and took a chance on getting it to the store that I got the furniture at. But there was no jobs. And you didn't know where that next meal was coming from. In fact, you didn't know if there was going to be a next meal. You just was out there on a limb, and you'd work, if you went on welfare, they'd give you $2.50 a week to live on, and some things you couldn't buy on that, certain items. And you worked for the city all week long, and kept ahead of it, a week ahead. They give you $2 and a hay. And we was just on starvation, people starving, in a land of plenty. And that Depression didn't look very good. But one day, my boat come home, and I unloaded it. So the only president I know of in my time, before my time, was Franklin D. Roosevelt. He took office in 3 months. He had jobs at medical. He made jobs, and he sat down on these manufacturers that spent millions to keep Republicans in the office there in Washington so they could work a man for a little or nothing. And he sat down on them, told them, don't you work this man over. Peter, one day you pay him time and a half. It was a law. 40 hours a week, it's a law. You pay him time and a half. And we began to live a little bit then, as he went on, and prosperity began to grow. He might have wasn't voted, but he put the prohibition days behind and brought back, and the country was wet, they call it. And that gives millions and millions of jobs. It still is. And he was the only president. I do have a reference to 2 more since him. And that was Jimmy Carter. I respected him as president. He was tied up. He couldn't do nothing for the Republicans. And then turned around, and his companies all was against him. Democratic Party. But Roosevelt, he said, well, listen, you go out there, if you want to organize labor, you organize it. The government ain't going to stop you. so we did, and looked at that millions of jobs, and actually put us where we are right now, prosperity, or we wouldn't have had it. It'd have been just like them days, regular Depression days. He brought it out of it. Now, Jimmy Carter couldn't do nothing. They had him tied. And so did they have, to a certain extent, they had Kennedy tied down too, but he would have got his way out if he'd lasted long enough. And that started these things rolling back.
During the Depression, didn't you work for the WPA?
Yeah, I worked for the WPA. We'd work for them, and no matter what the weather was, in zero or not, I'd come home with my coat covered with ice, working outside. And I worked for them, and they give us $65 every 2 weeks. We got a check, $65. Well, we could get by and live, have stuff to eat and clothes and a warm place for the family. And that was something. And after that settled down, prosperity began to go on and on, get better and better. And then them things stopped. We made jobs for the young boys. We graduated from college. Didn't have a job to come to. There were no jobs to have. And many a time, again, during them Depression days, and not one red penny in my pocket, none at home.
When you worked when you worked for the WPA, what project or projects did you work on?
I worked on the Mason Run. That's a Mason Run they put in to run to drain the water off way up in that section, and all of us driving all around up to there across to Telegraph. And then they started a project over in my neighborhood right close to home. In fact, I worked right by my home. Some we were making drainage there along the roads so the water wouldn't stand there. It'd run off down into the marsh. I worked on that, and I was working on that when they stopped it. Then when I went back to my plant at the auto equipment again.
Speaking of the Monroe Auto Equipment, you worked there for 45 years.
Yeah.
How did the plant change, and how did your job change during World War II?
Well, the McIntyre boys, the younger generation, as they grew up, they prospered and went out and prospered and made jobs and stuff. Then when the war broke out, World War II, we went into full production on military stuff for the Army, Navy, and we had all kinds. And I worked in there 7 days a week, and go in at 4 o'clock, get off at 4, and sometimes if I wanted to rain before I got home, I had to call me right back in. And that wasn't easy, but you had to have a good excuse to lay off a day, because you had papers filled out while you was off. And I worked for them. We had all kinds of parts. We were making from 20 millimeter shells, and finally went from a 37 millimeter shell there to 75 and 50 millimeters. And when they'd ship them out to these destinations, they had boxcars, and they'd load them boxcars to the top as long as they could get box in there. And I had a part in just about all of their machines on just about all the stuff we had there. And I was a job setter. A job setter has got so many machines there to go on, and maybe mine was scattered out throughout the plant. It wasn't all one group. I'd have to go over to them, and if trouble come up, well, then I had to step in and see what the trouble was causing the trouble, and fix it, and then get it back on the ball as quick as I could. So the company thought so much of me that they deferred me from the Army from going. I was in 1A class. I was subject to go any day. And I went in one morning to work, And I told the superintendent and the foreman, production manager, that I wouldn't be with them much longer. They wanted to know why, so I pulled my card out, showed it to them. I said, one of them then took it. And he said, I'll take care of this, sure. So me and not knowing what he was going to do, he took it. And a few days later, I asked him, I said, say, what about my draft card? I said, you never get back. He said, don't worry, you'll get another one. So they deferred me right on through till they passed the age limit, was 36. Well, I'd passed over the 36 at that time, probably 37. And I went through with that. And after the war was over, then we went back in production. Because the government gave them all these machines that they put in that plant, automatics, and that's where their big started to go into real big business. They had all the machines to manufacture, easy rides, shock absorbers. They could chain them over with these jobs. And that's where the McIntyre boys really hit the jackpot.
Did you like working for the McIntyres? They're a pretty
affluent.
I loved
working for them.
Family.
Actually, the boys grew up because I worked during when the school was out in the summer. One of them, the youngest McIntyre, eventually come president of the company after the other two died. Me and him worked right side by side. I'd machine a piece, put it over here, and he'd take it and do what he's supposed to do to it, and work with him all the time. And we chewed tobacco, me and him, and one day he brought the wrong brand in, took a chew of it and said, here, Kirk, you take two. I took it, and I know it was tough. I said, in a few minutes, I looked at him, he was white, and he had to go home. He got the sick on it, and he never did forget that. It's the chew tobacco, me and him chewed.
Who was your family doctor while your children were growing up? And have you noticed, what is the difference between a family doctor today compared to back then? And what is the difference in the Mercy Hospital in Monroe today compared to hospital settings back then?
Well, our doctor, family doctor then, and most of the children he delivered was Dr. Blakely, which has passed away now. He doctored us and come to the home, delivered the baby at home. He didn't have to sit saying he's running to the hospital and stuff like that. And every one of them delivered at home. I think there's one doctor that delivered one. Outside of that, Dr. Blakely was the family doctor and took care of it. Brought his nurse right there. And he was a great fellow for a doctor. So the difference today was that they only had one small hospital here in Monroe. And today they've got a kind of a nursing home in there, a very small
place. That was the
Monroe Hospital. That was the Monroe Hospital, the only one it was. And then they eventually got to call the Mercy Hospital. It was run by the Catholic people. They got that. But when they built the big the other two, and then they submerged in the hospital, now I think it's the most wonderful thing ever was, because I've been in there two, three different times, and I got good treatment all the way around there, and it's much different than it was back in them days when you had nothing hardly.
Mm-hmm. You've been retired now. Since
1974, I retired. And
how did your life change after retirement?
Well, it went good for a while, and then I was like everybody else, I guess. Ailments, one thing and another, and still today, and this and that changed a whole lot. But when I was retired, I had a lot of ambitions about me and worked around the home about all the time. Really done a lot of work inside the home and outside, and it seemed like everything turned out pretty good after all. As I said, that old boat came to sail home.
What do you think Do you think that Monroe is better off with the progress that's being made in it now and within the last 5 or 6 years? Or would you prefer Monroe to be the way that it was, say, 40 years ago?
I wouldn't tell anybody that 40 years ago, it was, the prosperity hadn't stopped. It had still continued to go on, and still yet today. And I'd say today, I'd rather see prosperity, although at my age, like it is now, preference to the 40, because there's been a lot of crime and stuff throughout the whole United States has occurred during that time, and this time now is worse. And I would prefer the prosperity days above all. They say, well, you're getting high wages. But, well, yes, I'd rather get high wages than to work for cheaper and be practically without anything that needs necessities in life today.
Have you ever heard the myth about an underground railroad in the East End?
Well, one time they talked that. I didn't pay too much attention to it, but I figured it was something that would just go over. At first, I know it did. They talked about many things like that, and building bridges too, from through and through, you know, in the state, like the big bridge up north here. Something to come through with, and like building a tunnel through to Canada. Bridge, when I come there, they didn't have either one of them. You had to go across to Canada on a ferry boat. You drive down there and drive on a ferry boat, and they take you across. Now then, they got bridges across and they're trying to go through.
I'm referring to the underground railroads that supposedly existed that slaves escaped through. I heard years ago a lot of people thought because so many blacks congregated and lived in the East End area and in the Orchard,
yeah,
that there supposedly was an underground railroad in that area where they, it wasn't technically not a railroad, yeah, underground, but it was where they would go to flee to Canada or
I don't know too much about that. They talked that some, but I, all that stuff I didn't pay too much mind to that, because I thought that is an impossible thing and I didn't give it much attention to it.
What were your feelings about prohibition, bootlegging, and those types of things?
Yeah, when I was a kid growing up, as I said, 7, 8 years old, and I had quite a hand at my age. I wasn't hardly, I forgot in school age too. I worked at it. We made corn whiskey, stepfather, and I had a part in it. I ground all the malt. She did put up these barrels, and they would work, sugar and meal and stuff. And then they got to a certain place, you'd pour in this malt, they called it now. You sprouted your corn under the house, a little brown sprout, and you dried it in your oven. Then you put it through this old hand mill and grind for days and days at a time, see? And my stepfather would take, when he got the right time, he put so much of that into his barrels. He maybe have 4 or 5 barrels or pretty soon be ready to distill. He put that in there, and that kept, that was my job, see, taking care of that corn and grinding it up and everything for him. We made straight corn whiskey, sold for $40 a gallon back in 1919, $40 a gallon. We just had a barrel in there and good corn whiskey and train, paving train stopped. And the engineer would get out and come in and give him a bottle of whiskey and his buddy and get on a train and go on back to town. And such as that, I didn't think nothing of it. Me being a kid, thought that's way all over. But bootlegging then was not like it is today, but they didn't bother you. The sheriff there and his deputy lived off the railroad almost ways, and the old man he'd start making it night. We had a home, and we had what we call cow stables up off the ground over there, and the wash house over here where you took baths and all that. We had a place between that, see, you could look around it, you wouldn't know it. A room in there that they were still in. And I seen the deputy, there was a deputy sheriff and his son. His son was a deputy, and he was a sheriff, great big guy. He'd come down there and go in there, you know, he had time getting through that panel door. Knowing it was in there, you couldn't tell there's a hole there. He'd sit there and tasting it, he'd come out of that still, and had the old man tell him, this is a little bit high yet, so he'd keep doubling that back as you're coming out that still worm, and till it got to the right point, like 80 proof, 90 proof, 100 proof, you know. And that old guy, that old sheriff, he'd test it every few minutes, you know. He didn't care what it was, see. And finally, he'd get pretty well screwed up, him and his son, and they'd get him a bottle and hike back up the railroad track. Yeah, we made corn whiskey then. We almost got caught after moving to the country making it. We didn't, but we had to move that steel with no lights on in the country. Take it. I remember burying the steel worm in a manure pile. I wasn't going out in them dark woods to bury it. Quite a life to live, make a good book, whatever it is.